This is an ABC podcast.
The Oasis Youth Centre is in Surry Hills in inner city Sydney. And Oasis works with the kids that everyone else has given up on. Kids that are violent or suffering mental illness or addicted to drugs. Paul Moulds is a major with the Salvation Army, and he devoted many years of his life to running Oasis. Helping these kids change their lives is really hard work. But Paul says that however dark things got, Oasis was still a place of hope. The Salvo's next posting for Paul was the Australian Detention Centre on Manus Island. And one of his jobs now is teaching refugees in Western Sydney how to drive. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Sarah.
Your connection to the Salvo's goes way, way back. When did it start?
Yeah. Well, quite unusually, I was connected from a very early age, so I was adopted, and at that stage, I guess it shows what adoption was thought of, because there were homes for unmarried mothers where they could have their children and be adopted, and the Salvation Army ran some of those homes and those programs, and so I was born in a Salvation Army hospital for unmarried mums back in the 60s, and shows how far we've come as a society, doesn't it, these days, and I was adopted to a couple who were connected to the Salvation Army in a church sense and were unable to have their own children, and so had applied to be for an adoption.
And did you know growing up the story of how you came to your family?
Yeah, I actually had an adopted brother. So mum was always very upfront with us that we were wanted, we were loved, we were chosen. And that's quite a powerful thing, actually, to be chosen. So I knew from my earliest age that I was adopted.
Have you ever tried to find your birth parents?
Interesting. When the Oasis documentary was made, the producers were very keen for me to go on that journey.
How did you feel about it?
Look, it's never been a burning issue for me. I felt greatly loved growing up. I felt valued. I felt I had a rich experience of life growing up. So it hasn't been a burning issue. I mean, there's certainly curiosity and questions, and I have delved, but I applied to the adoption register, but my natural mother's never sought to, her name's not on it. So I haven't gone looking through private investigators or doing major searching. I mean, I'd be very open if someone tapped me on the shoulder and said, you know, this was your life, but it's never been a burning thing that I feel for my life to be complete, I have to know that.
Tell me about what happened in your family when you were just nine.
Well, we grew up in Western Sydney, in Windsor, which is sort of a semi-rural area, and I had a sort of a great experience, but when I was nine, Dad he'd had an accident, a workplace accident, and for about 2 years he was very unwell. I never actually quite understood what was going on, but he was always in hospital. Then he'd come home for a little while, and he had a brain injury, and so he was often unable to really, you know, be present for you. So that was a difficult time. And then when he was nine, he died. So that left Mum on her own with two boys. We struggled financially from that point. Mum was on the single mum's pension. And, it was a difficult time. But it was we got through.
Were there other men, Paul, who stepped in as kind of father figures
for
you?
I have to say, one of the rich things about being part of a church community for me, and I grew up, the Salvation Army has a church as well as its social arm, and in many suburbs that church exists. And one of the rich things for me was people who became a surrogate father. I mean, people, we were never able to afford holidays, but people would take me away with them on their own holidays, and people would invite you over to weekends, and someone taught me how to drive. And in many ways, there were people that stepped in. It doesn't mean that you don't miss your own father. And in later life, I've come to realise it has had an impact on my own personal life, but there were people that helped us and stepped in and were important role models. And I think one of the things that I saw in my work with young people throughout the years is that often what is missing is that strong parental role model. Now, that's not to say that good families, that kids don't become homeless and have troubles and get involved in drugs. But I have to say, over all the years, over all the kids I've seen, that those lacking, that lacking strong parental models, but absent families, and neglect and abuse, obviously, but even absent can have a big impact on young people.
What kind of student were you at school?
I was always pretty studious at school. I mean, study came naturally to me. I went to a state school and state high school and state primary school, and I did okay. Mum had never had an education, really. She didn't, I think, value education quite as much. So, and there wasn't anyone telling me to do homework and stuff like that. So I tried to do it. I think I could have done a lot better if I had have had someone driving me a bit. I tended to be a bit on the lazy side, but I got through, and I went to Sydney University when I finished school.
Well, that's more than getting through.
Yeah.
That's really impressive. Yeah. I mean, was your mum proud of that?
Oh, yeah, I think she definitely was. I think she certainly was. I mean, I think one of the happiest days was when I graduated many years later, because it took me a while to finish that degree for certain reasons. And I think it was one of her proudest days to come to my graduation, yeah.
Did you stay connected to the Salvation Army when you were a teenager?
Mum was always a very active member of the local church, the local Salvation Army. She was a very caring person. She role-modelled for me a beautiful heart of giving to others. She would, you know, stand on the street and collect donations for them. She was always the first to, if a neighbour was in trouble, she'd make a cake for them or drop them in. So I had some good role models in that way.
You didn't go through a teenage rebellion stage?
I actually didn't. No, not in that sense. I certainly had a point in my life when I went to university where I questioned my faith. I had grown up accepting that this is the way things are, what I'd been taught was true. And certainly when I went to university, it was a great experience to become more critical in my thinking, to really examine what I believe, what was important to me, what I was going to build, the foundations on which I was building my life. And I came through that after thinking about it and even stopped going to church for a little while. But I came through believing that, for me, the Christian faith was a great bedrock on which I could build my life and future.
Tell me about the first time you started working at King's Cross when you were still just a teenager. How did that happen?
Well, when I went to university, I enrolled to be a teacher, actually. I was doing teaching at Sydney University. And that was good. I did 1 year there, and I came to my uni holidays, and I'd started volunteering. I mean, that's right. I'd started volunteering at King's Cross, actually. Salvation Army had opened a youth centre there, and they were doing street outreach work. So I was really keen to, I mean, I really had a strong sense of social justice. One of the things growing up in the Salvation Army, I'd seen human need already. I'd seen people suffering. I'd been out delivering food parcels to people. I'd been out at emergencies feeding people. So I had that sense, and I started volunteering while I was at uni at King's Cross at a program there the Salvation Army was running. It was a really innovative program. It was a street outreach-based program. These are in the early 80s. So the Cross, I mean, for me it was such an eye. I'd never seen anything like it.
What did you encounter on the streets at night?
These were the days when, names like Abe Saffron around, who ran the Cross, the crime, there were police being paid. I knew all this because the kids would tell me, and we would go out to the parks, we would go to the areas of prostitution, the areas where young people hung out, and our role was simply to befriend them, to begin a conversation, to build trust so that we could offer them an alternative pathway. We could offer them referrals. We could help them see that there might be a different way out. So I started that work, and then when it came to my uni holidays, I was offered the opportunity to work full-time there. Up until then, I'd just sort of occasionally gone up there one night a fortnight or so. So I immersed myself in that environment. And it was suddenly every night I was on the street, every afternoon I was out talking to kids. The wall, the famous wall was there, the in, and male prostitution and female prostitution, young kids, you know, selling themselves. And we would go and talk to them and befriend them, and often they would run away to, you know, go and do a job or something like that. And my first introduction to see drugs and the impact of drugs on people's lives. So it was a very challenging experience, and but it felt right for me.
What about it felt right?
It felt right that this is something it's worth giving your life to. I mean, I had an experience during those 3 months that really did change my life. While I was there, early on when I went to work full-time, I met a young guy called Mark. And Mark was from out in Western Sydney. I think he was 17 years of age at the time that I met him. And he was one of those kids that was, like, he had the toughest exterior. And I'll never forget how I met him. In those days, not so much these days because real estate doesn't allow it, but a lot of the kids lived in squats. These were abandoned buildings in King's Cross and in the city, where kids would live and just live without electricity. It was a place that they'd just sleep. And one of the rules of street work was you don't go into these places at night. But the other thing about street work and what we were doing was trying to build credibility with the kids. And so one night a kid came to me on the streets and said, look, can you go to visit this guy who was living in a squat? And he told me about this young boy, an intellectually disabled boy. And he was outraged. He said to me, you know, they're actually making him do all sorts of things, manner of sex jobs and that, and they're only giving him a cigarette. It's wrong, he said. You guys, you salvos, you should go and stop this. And, you know, he wasn't outraged about what he was doing, but the fact that he was being ripped off,
trade union issue.
He wasn't getting the proper payment. And so he said, will you go and see this kid? So even though the rules were that you shouldn't go to a squat at night, I decided to go and see whether I could help this kid, because being available, being credible for the kids, when they started to open up, when they started asking for help, that's vital for a street outreach worker. So I go to this place. It was maybe 9 o'clock at night or so. I just went to the front door and I yelled out, is anyone in there? I'm looking for the name of the guy. And out of the shadow stepped Mark. Now, Mark looked like he actually came from an army disposal shop. He had those high lace-up boots. He had khaki on. And in his hand, he had this huge blade that literally was glistening in the moonlight. So immediately I see him, I decide it's time to leave. So I back down the steps. It was a terrace house. I back down the steps and I say, oh, I was looking for this guy, but I can see that user guys are busy, so I'll just be on my way. And I didn't get to the bottom of the stairs, and he screamed at me, stop! And he said to me, don't ever think you can help me, but if you want to help someone, go and see this kid. And he told me about the same story about this boy who was really in need and being abused and being taken advantage of. So I went past him and went in. So that was my first introduction to Mark. And after that, often I'd see him on the streets of King's Cross. And we got to know each other really well.
And what did he tell you about his story?
He told me that he was one of, I think, 6 or 7 kids. I can't 100% remember. But he was the oldest. And he'd dropped out of school at year 9 or something. He just sat around all day at home. And his mum, thinking that this would motivate him, single mum, not able to cope really, said to him, it's time that you make your own way in the world. And showed him the door. I think she gave him $150 and said, go into the city, rent a room, and go and find a job. But here's a kid, no life skills, no work skills. And so he wanders into the city, he pays his week's rent, finds that's used up, and then he's on the streets. So many stories like that lead people into homelessness. And he wandered into King's Cross, and he found other kids like himself, and he adopted this image of, I'm a tough guy. I'm, you know, you cannot come near me, stay away from me, I'm a tough guy. So that was my introduction to Mark, but I got to know him really well. And, you know, often he saw himself as the friend of the salvos in the cross. I remember sometimes people, like, you'd be standing talking to a prostitute or something like this, and some of the tourists would think that's quite funny to see a salvo, because we were in uniforms, talking to this, and they'd have a say. And then out of the shadows would step Mark, and he'd tell them, stay away from these people, you know, they're good people, and tell these people where to go.
Was there a moment where you had established a kind of relationship where he could open up to you?
Well, and that's the key, I think. I think that's the key about this work is you've got a journey with people. You can't go in and instantly expect that people are going to be ready to be rescued, ready to be saved, or things like that. You've got to, you know, when people have had those sort of experiences where their own families have let them down, where they've known great trauma, great pain, great rejection, abuse. It's a long journey to start trusting that someone actually can be there for the right reasons. And one day, after maybe 2 months when I'd known him, Mark came to see me at my office. I remember it was significant. So I'd always seen him on the street, but one day he came to our office and he asked for me. And he was that tough image, the first time ever I saw it, that tough image was gone. And this was a 17-year-old scared boy. And one of his mates in the cross that he'd got particularly close to had a really bad overdose and had been taken to St. Vincent's Hospital and was hovering between life and death. And he didn't know what to do. He didn't know how to deal with this. So he remembered the people that actually spoke to him and tried to care. And so he came to see me. And that tough image was gone. He was scared and he was sad. And we went to see his mate at St. Vincent's, but more importantly, started talking to me about his own life. And he said, I don't want this to happen to me. I want my life to be different. I know it can be different. And so we talked about rehab and we talked about dealing with his drug addiction, which was significant in his life and sort of drove off a lot of his behaviour. And he made a decision that he'd go to a drug rehab. And so I took him down there. It was in Albion Street in Surry Hills. Booked him in, and I only got to see him once more after that. I think I went to visit him once, but he was in the program and he was on his way. And then one day, not long after that, I got a phone call, and they told me that Mark had a big argument in the program. He'd stormed out of the program, and he'd left in a really bad state. After he was fighting with someone else, him and another resident had a big argument, and he hadn't, and he'd stormed out. And apparently, I still don't 100% know to what happened to this day, but he stormed off and he went back to, he must have gone back and taken some drugs, to try and, I guess, deal with that, those feelings. That he was only at the beginning of trying to learn how to deal with feelings in a different way. And so he used some drugs. And apparently, he was walking through a street in Western Sydney and someone had parked a car there and left the keys in the ignition. And in his state of mind, he thought, this will be a joyride. I don't know what was he thinking. And he jumped in the car and he took off and the car hit a telegraph pole. And at the age of 18, he just turned 18, his life came to an end. And I'll never forget the day they rang and told me about that, what had happened to Mark. And I thought of the lost potential and I thought of what I can do with my life. It was quite a defining moment for me because up until then I was going to go back to uni and I was going to become a teacher. And that was going to be my life's work. But I just felt that there's nothing more for me that I can give than to make a decision. So I made a decision that day in honour of Mark and in memory of him that I would become a youth worker. So I changed my degree. I went back to uni part-time. Because at the end of my holiday job, the Salvos offered me the full-time job at that centre. And so for the next 2 years, I worked at King's Cross. And it took me 5 years to finish my degree because I did it part-time. And that's been my journey, I guess.
How did you meet your wife, Paul?
Well, that King's Cross was a significant moment for me because I met her there too. Actually, she jokes about it and says that I met her on the streets of King's Cross, which is true because she was a volunteer street outreacher too. So, yeah, but not quite in the way that that looks. She was a very devoted, passionate worker for justice and wanted to make a difference with her life too, and I was attracted to that. I was attracted to her passion and to her care for people. And so she was a youth worker. She was just a volunteer there, and I was the centre youth worker. And we used to work the same shifts together, so we got to know each other and eventually married.
When you two had your own young kids, tell me about the house you lived in with your own young children.
Yeah, so after that, so I worked at King's Cross for a couple of years, and Robin went on actually also to be a youth worker, trained as a youth worker, and worked in our youth refuge for a while. But we felt that we should move in. At that stage, I was working for Mission Australia, and there was a home in Crow's Nest in Sydney, actually, that they had obtained, and they wanted house parents there. So there were 10 young people lived there, and we lived in a like a little caretaker's flat that was attached to the house. The young people who lived there were supposed to be independent in the sense that they could cook for themselves and they could maintain some semblance of stability in their lives. And we were there just to guide them and create an environment to make sure they didn't have wild parties at night. But they didn't all really have that level of stability, let me tell you.
So what did you and Robin have to do for them?
Well, we tried to create, I guess the most important thing is we tried to create an atmosphere in the house where people felt, again, people felt valued, people felt this is a safe environment. And that's a challenge because, you know, you've got to, when people are acting in a way that makes others feel threatened, and this was always my dilemma at Oasis, sometimes for the greater good, you have to say to a person, hey, this is not the right place for you at the moment because other people, you need to respect that others need a safe environment. So, yeah, we wanted to create a safe environment. We wanted people to feel valued. I mean, again, we weren't their caseworkers. We were just the house parents trying to model for them what life is and be available when they had a rotten day, or they could come, there was someone there they could talk to about it.
And also learning how to be parents to your own kids.
Well, they were very young, our children.
What sort of things did they experience, your kids, in that house?
Well, we were separate, but look, you know, one of the things, I mean, Robin's far better at this than me. She's very strong with boundaries and she's very good at, making sure and reminding me that my own kids were important and significant. She made sure that our own kids were well looked after. But look, sometimes things happen in that place that were crazy. I mean, we always felt that we had some sort of, can I say, divine protection, because I don't think our kids were ever exposed. There were some pretty crazy things happen. One of the kids one day, I'll never forget, ran into the garage. Again, you learn lessons, don't you? You don't put tools in garages, and grabbed an axe. He was so angry and so furious and ran into the house, began chopping. He was trying to get through a door to someone and got the axe and began chopping and screaming and that. But our kids weren't there at that day. So we were grateful for that. In many ways, our kids were enriched by the experience. We would have meals together. They learnt, I think, they also learnt something about giving and sharing and family in a bigger sense beyond their own family. So it was a rich experience, and we were just glad that, you know, that they were also protected.
You and Robin became officers with the Salvation Army. What does that actually mean?
Well, we worked for a number of years for different organisations. We were always part of the Salvation Army in the sense of we attended the Salvation Army as a church on a Sunday. That was our way of, you know, demonstrating our faith. We tried to do a bit of volunteer work with them. But our work, I worked for Mission Australia. I worked for Wesley Mission for some years. They were careers. We were having youth work. But always in my heart, I felt I wanted to be, I guess I wanted this to be a vocation rather than a career. And I felt for me, the Salvation Army offered that. Becoming a Salvation Army officer is not, you're not an employer. They're not my employer. I have a covenant relationship with them.
So it's more like being a priest in a sense.
It is in a sense, although thank God you're able to marry and do all those things that sometimes priests can't do. But it is certainly a calling, and that's what I felt. You know, in hindsight, when I was 18 at school, I really had a sense of social justice. One of my mates gave me this. For when we left school, he gave me this. He said, Paul, I'm giving you this because I think this is what your life's going to be. And it was a saying, a quote, and it still hangs in my office today. He actually calligraphied it. He was a beautiful artistic gift he had. And he calligraphied this, and it still sits in my office today. And it says this: some want to work within the sound of church or chapel bell. I want to run a rescue shop within a yard of hell. And it had something to say about my faith, that I didn't want a faith that was going to church once a week or singing hymns. And I wanted a faith that was real and that was really, really played out in the way that we could impact people. So
you wanted to be right there within gates of hell. What's the phrase?
Some people like to hang around church, but I want to run a rescue shop within a yard of hell, meaning that I want to grab people, you know, those that are struggling with life, those that are falling over the edge of the cliff. I want to grab them and help them. And that was when I was 18, actually, he gave me that. And we were actually volunteering together at King's Cross. And I think he knew that one day this would be my whole life's passion. That's what it became. So, I mean, in some ways it was a delayed thing. I got caught up a bit in being a career youth worker, and I went on to be, I was director of youth services for Mission Australia, Sydney City Mission it was at that stage, for a while. But ultimately, I had to make this decision, and Salvation Army officership has suited us because it is a vocation. It is something that it's a life rather than it is a job.
Do you have power over deciding where you're sent as a Salvation Army officer?
Well, one of the big things that's correct. One of the big things that's prevented us from, I think, maybe making that decision was that as a Salvation Army officer, you give up the right to choose where you work. So you're appointed.
Why is that?
It's a bit like, I guess, being a priest again, is that they make a decision in consultation with you about where your skills could be best used. So you could be sent to Broken Hill, or you can be sent to Far North Queensland to do a work. Now, they discuss that, but ultimately you say, I will go where I'm needed and where I'm sent. And I think giving up that autonomy was a big step, because I really felt passionate about being at the gates of hell, and certainly working with young people. And so that was a big step. But, you know, I guess, again, what happened during the time we went to college for 2 years, a residential college, to train to be officers. And during that time, you go on placement. And I was sent into the inner city to look at the youth work of the Salvation Armies in the inner city, because I'd had a lot of skills and experience in that. And I made a report recommending some future steps they could take to improve those services. And just before I graduated, or was appointed to my first appointment, the Commissioner of the Salvation Army contacted me and said, Paul, we want to send you back to the inner city to implement those recommendations to change the way that we do youth work in the inner city.
And where did they send you?
They sent me to, well, the Oasis didn't really exist then, but they sent me to the homeless youth work of the Salvation Army in Sydney to lead it and to redesign it.
You're listening to Conversations with Sarah Kanoski on ABC Radio.
Tell me, Paul, when you and Robin go to work at Oasis, what kind of situations were the kids there facing? What did they need?
Well, I'd had a lot of experience working with kids in the inner city, so I sort of knew when I went there. I'd also done the report with some recommendations. What I realised, I think, was that the kids needed a lot more than just a bed or a meal. They actually needed, it's those intangible things. It's hard even to describe. They needed hope, and they needed to see there was a pathway. You know, the hardest thing for us to work with homeless kids is their lack of self-belief, their acceptance that this is life, this is the way it's always been, this is how it's always going to be. And while a bed's important, and while feeding them and making sure that those essentials of life are there, you have to challenge those deep self-perceptions that this is life. You know, one of the problems that we encounter with homeless kids, I guess the saddest thing in my work, has been they take a lot of risks with life. And when you're talking to a young person who might be like your own child, you can almost reason with them and argue, you know, this is risky behaviour. You know, this is going to affect your ability to get ahead in life, to get your degree. You know, if you're going to smoke marijuana every day, you're not going to be able to do your exams. You know, you can talk to people about how those things. But when you're talking to a young person who's had the sort of experiences that lead them into homelessness, they look at you blankly and they shrug their shoulders. What does it matter? You know, I've not got no future. I've got no life. They live for the moment. And so we needed to create, if Oasis was truly going to be an oasis, rather than just a bed and a meal, we had to create pathways, opportunities where young people could dream again, where they could see a potential and a future that they couldn't see right now. Now, that comes from walking alongside of them, speaking life into them. One of the things that I'm always conscious of is that you may be the only person in that kid's life who's speaking life to them, rather than, you know, talking to them about drugs and how they can make money from selling themselves or whatever it is. You might be that. So you've got to speak life, but you also, it's also got to be tangible. So we started creating things like an outdoor adventure program. We started creating music programs, creative programs. We realized that we needed a school, a special school. You know, like we, these young people weren't dumb. Education hadn't worked for them, often because of their chaotic lives, but they could learn. But the school needed to be accessible. It needed to meet their needs. So it was a school like that provided breakfast in the morning. It was a school where you, if you could sit for half an hour, you needed smoke. You could walk out in the back, and there was a smokers area. It was a school where if you could only come to school for 3 hours a day or 2 hours a day, you could come and do your work, and then we'd release you. So creating those programs was what our life's work became. Because when I went there, Oasis really was just a bed and a meal. And what we did over those next years is we tried to create programs that would say to young people, no matter how bad their life experience was, you matter, you're important, life hasn't passed you by, you can achieve.
A lot of those kids are really angry, and often that gets directed right at you. How do you handle that?
I think you realise, obviously, it's never about you. That no matter how much they scream at you, no matter how much they rant and rave and swear and call you every name of the sun, that's life they're angry at. I never had a problem with that. There was only once in my whole career that I've had any physical violence done to me, and that was from a young guy who had a terribly bad mental illness. And I'd worked with this guy for ages, and I misjudged him one day, and he was so delusional, and he actually threw me through a glass window, a big pane glass window. That's the only time I've ever had an experience of that, and I learned from that experience too. But in most of it,
were you
verbal,
injured from that?
I was shocked. I was cut a little bit, but I went through the glass, broke the glass. Unfortunately, I went backwards, so I landed on the glass. But no, it wasn't. It wasn't. It was no serious injuries. It was a shock for me. I didn't expect it.
So what was your usual way of dealing with a kid who's off their face on drugs or they're enraged at something and they're holding a chair?
Yeah, sure.
How do you deal with it?
You can't deal with it at the time. You've got to allow a person to look. You could spend an hour talking to a person at that point about trying to convince them that their thinking's not wrong, that they're valuable, but they're not going to remember that the next day. So you've got to choose your time. At that sort of point of time, you're just trying to contain a person, de-escalate them, and put them in a safe environment. Send them to bed is the best thing if you can do it. If not, you need to send them out of the centre for a while or ask them to go for a walk to the park. So, you know, every young person's different, I should say, but there's some general rules. Look, the young people could be aggressive, but a lot of that also, I mean, the saddest thing is a lot of it's turned against themselves. And there's a lot of self-harm, a lot of cutting, a lot of, and basically not really seeing that they're valuable.
Tell me about one of the kids you worked with at Oasis, Owen.
Yeah.
He was one of those angry kids.
Yeah. Well, Oasis, I would actually, you see him in the documentary at his worst.
This is a documentary that was made following
it was made
the lives
actually,
of...
I think 10 years ago, so 2008, was made there. The story of that's amazing, how that came to be made is amazing.
Well, tell me that.
Okay. Well, we just got on and did our work. One Christmas, actually, Christmas was a really sad time at Oasis because at Christmas you miss most what you don't have. You realise that everyone's celebrating with family, people are having a good time, and you don't have that. So we tried to go, at Christmas we would drop into the centre and try and make something. But I always saw there was so much sadness and so much drug abuse high and alcohol high. The kids are out getting stoned and drunk. And so that first year that we went to the centre, we determined that we'd try and do something different. So what we did is we tried to create like a festival on Christmas. So we, brought in jumping castles and activities, and we opened the centre up and we invited people in. I think the first year we had about 200 turn up, and the next year was 400. And I think the last year we did Christmas, there was 1,000 people turned up. And my wife organised that. She's an amazing organiser. So Christmas was a difficult time.
And you had a volunteer, I think, turn up at one of those Christmases.
Right. Yes. And one day, a guy turned up and said, oh, I'm here to volunteer. And so that Christmas, where we needed someone to help was in washing the dishes. So we just sent him into the dishes. And I don't know how he experienced the event. But after that, he sent us a very nice donation. I didn't know who this man was, but he was a philanthropist. And his name's Ian Darling, and he's a filmmaker also. And later on, he came back to visit us at Oasis. He wanted to know about our work, and he actually eventually became the chairman of our advisory board. And he said to me one day, Paul, the story of these kids need to be told. People don't understand the depth and the despair that young people feel. People don't see what happens in this place. And so he put forward an idea to do a documentary. I didn't know what that meant, but it was a unique documentary because it wasn't a one-off, one-moment look at these kids' life. It actually followed the lives of the kids for over a year, and it traced them coming to Oasis, and it tried to follow them, those that left and went to the squats, and those that went to the streets, and those that went into other types of housing that we provided. And it really tried to document their lives. It was an enormously powerful thing.
What reaction did the public have to that screening?
Well, I mean, I'll never forget the night that it was shown on the ABC, actually. And there was a forum afterwards too, which the Minister for Housing came to, and they ran a Q&A afterwards. But that was it. Next morning, I'll never forget, I went into work at, something 6 o'clock or something like that. I drove into work, and there were two cars pulled up out the centre, and two people who had seen the documentary the night before, and they'd been so moved and so overwhelmed that they'd driven there to wait till I came to work to actually give me two checks to work for our work. Well, then I realised, wow, maybe this is going to have an impact, and it certainly did. I mean, that was the beginning of a huge impact for Oasis. People donated. We were able to open more beds, do more programs. Eventually, the documentary was placed in the schools as a curriculum resource, and schools would come and visit. So suddenly, I realised at that point that not only could we do something for the kids, but we could be a voice in the community. We could be an advocate for those that were homeless. And so that began a whole nother sort of journey of Oasis, where we really tried to meet with politicians, say, look, can't we do better than what we're doing now? Can't there be more resources given to this work?
And one of the kids featured on that documentary is Owen, who, when we first meet him, is young and incredibly violent and angry.
Tell me
about your journey with him.
Owen represents the best of Oasis, really. I mean, it represents what happens when you don't give up. I mean, I have to say this. I can't tell you how many arguments I had with staff about Owen, because everyone thought this kid is too abusive at the centre. I mean, he was the sort of kid, he'd get so angry. We had to get rid of all the glass in the centre just about, because when he was in anger, he'd just put his fist through it. He would kick the glass. And eventually we put Perspex everywhere because... And he was angry. He would bring drugs onto the centre. I mean, I had a rule, obviously we dealt with kids that use drugs, and we could deal with that, but you don't bring them into the centre. You don't deal at the place that we're trying to...
Why didn't you give up on a kid who's behaving like that?
Well, we could have given up on lots, and Owen was just one of many that we had to... I mean, there's always something in these kids that you see, you always see the potential, and you realise that underneath all that anger and underneath all that pain is someone that you can help, I think. Now, you can, some you don't, unfortunately, but and what makes the difference, I don't know. But Owen, we didn't give up on. And one of the things that one day, I'll never forget, Owen tells this story himself. One day he walked into our music program. He never would engage in any work. We'd try and get him in the school. He was only about 15 or 16 at the time. But he came into the music program, and you could just see he was enraptured. It just opened up another world to him. And he had a real gift of lyric writing. And he wrote that day his first song. And it was a rap, because he loved rap. And and he produced this track with his rap, and he was so proud of it, and he'd take it and show it to everyone. Now, that didn't transform his life, but it was the beginning of something that we could use to be a pathway to something different. So that was Owen 10 years ago. Well, today Owen is still in touch with us. And in fact, about 3 years ago, he contacted us when we went to Auburn, and things weren't going well for him. He was facing a homelessness crisis again. And one of the things that you've got to also realise in this work is you've got to be there for the long term, because when you face a crisis in your life, the people that pick you up, that come around, your family aren't there. Who is going to do that? So he rang us up, and he was in a really bad way, not drug-wise, but just chaotic with his lifestyle and didn't have any money to pay rent and all that. So he came to live in one of our houses that we have in Auburn now, and he's still there a couple of years later. But since then, he's done a course at the Sydney Film and Music School, and he started his own business. He has his own entertainment business. He works in the music industry, and every time I see him, he's a reminder to me that, life has changed and destinies can change. I mean, Owen was definitely on a course to full-time incarceration or an early death. There is no doubt about that. And yet his life has gone a different direction. And that's what you get up for every day.
When you and Robin were running Oasis, Paul, did you have a life outside of that work?
You do. I mean, it is all encompassing.
You're not making eye contact with me when you're saying that, Paul. I wonder if I should ask Robin.
Look, Robin's been a great reminder. Robin is much stronger than me in remembering that we have our own family that we need to invest in, that we have a life outside of this, and we have friends and we have people that we connect with. And, she's been, it's been a great partnership, really.
Well, there must have been days, though, when you'd come home and think, this is so hard, or my heart's broken. I can't keep doing it.
I have to say that the thing that's got me through there is my faith. One of the hardest things in my life was I had a phone call one night from a young guy called Chris. Chris changed his life too. He was like Owen. He was one of the toughest of the tough kids. But he'd stabilised. He hadn't totally got out of the woods, but he'd stabilised enough. We got him a little flat of his own, and he was living in this little flat of his own. One night at midnight, he rings me. He says, Paul, he says, I've locked my keys out of the flat. And he was living in a flat, and we was on the third level balcony. He said, I've locked my keys out. Can you come and let me in? It's midnight. I'm home at midnight. I said, all right, Chris, I'll meet you at Oasis, because I've got a spare key, because we always had a spare key to his flat. So I drive in to Oasis, and he's not there. So I waited, 15 minutes or so, and he wasn't there, so I went home. The next day, I get a phone call from the police. So Chris has tried to scale the building to get into his flat, has fallen and died. And Chris was someone that we'd invested so much in. That was a hard day, I can tell you, a hard day. I did his funeral, actually. But the night before I did his funeral, I had a dream. And I'll never forget that dream. I dreamt, there's a verse in the Bible that says, and underneath are the everlasting arms that will never let you fall. And that next day, I preached in his funeral that while Chris's body fell to the ground, his soul was captured. And I believe that. I believe that. And that's what gets me through often. I do have a faith. I do believe that when I reach the end of my resources, that there is power beyond me that helps me do it, and that's got me through.
Why did you leave Oasis?
After the documentary, we got into the advocacy in a big way. So we were going to Canberra, we were trying to meet with politicians, and the Salvation Army sort of reappointed me, I had to go to head office to work in strategic planning.
Death by management. Yeah, is that what happened to you?
Well, I did go into head office. It wasn't me, that's certainly true. And I was leading the Salvation Army Social Services in New South Wales. It was a head office job, yes.
So how did you then go to Manus and Nauru? What were the Salvos doing there?
Was to look at emerging areas of work that the Army should be moving into. And at that stage, the government had decided to open offshore processing. And we'd been doing some work with refugees in Australia. And I knew that this was going to be a terrible terrible place. I knew that. And we actually approached the government. I convinced the army to approach the government and offer to go as a welfare provider, to be with the people, simply like what we did at OASA, to journey with them, to be present with them. And so the government did give us a contract as a welfare provider, and we went to Manus Island, and it was the most difficult experience, I thought, difficult days at OASIS. It was trying to convince people to have hope who had absolutely no hope, who cut themselves, who would, you know, I've cut people down from trees who were trying to hang themselves. So things that I'd never done at OASIS, I experienced in that place.
What was your role? What did you imagine that you'd be able to do there?
Yeah, well, we thought that we could bring hope to these people. We knew that, look, the determination of their cases is outside our brief. But what we wanted to do was to try and, while they waited, we wanted to do vocational education programs. We wanted to bring meaning to their lives. But every effort we did, we were thwarted by the government, I have to say. I mean, I wrote so many proposals. We wanted to run a little coffee program on the island, train them all to be baristas. We wanted to run vocational training. No, basically they gave us soccer balls and said, kick a soccer ball around with them for, and you can do that for a couple of days, but not month after month.
Why? Were you given reasons why those initiatives were refused?
I don't know. It was cruelty like I haven't experienced. In the army, you know, pulled out of that, and I went, and so I was working on this from Sydney, but I felt my people were suffering and experiencing such difficult times there that I went myself to lead the team. With my wife, we both went and we lived in a shipping container on Manus Island, trying to bring hope to those people, spending time with them, talking to them. But our hands were tied. It was talking. There was nothing more we could do. You know, at OASIS, I could do anything. I could send a kid out on an outdoor adventure program. I could get into a rehab program. There, it was like our hands were tied and all we could do was talk. And it was a difficult experience.
How did it affect you and Robin being in that environment and seeing that need and not being able to do anything?
For the first time, I experienced some very severe personal crises in my own life. Things that I had unresolved in my life emerged. We came back to Australia and we basically took 8 months off from work and went to America for a sabbatical, lived in Boston, which was an amazing experience.
You spoke out publicly against those detention facilities.
Mm. We weren't allowed to speak out. That was the contract forbade you. That was the other thing. We're in Australia. You could speak with a voice. The contract actually forbade you to speak against.
So was it after the end of the contract that you made those criticisms?
Oh, no, I think I did them during the contract, but you weren't supposed... Oh, the arguments I had with the department.
Do?
Oh, my goodness, the things that I've been... You know, I can handle a street kid telling me certain things, but it's a bit difficult when it's someone, a bureaucrat, telling you. It was a difficult time. And
what do you take away from that experience at Manus?
Well, amazingly, see, this again, out of that, I would love for refugees arose, and that's where I work today. So out of that experience, who would have known? When I came back from my sabbatical, I wondered whether I'd continue in social work. And then eventually we did, and we thought we'd be appointed back to homelessness again. But they asked us whether we would go to Auburn, which is the most multicultural community in Australia, full of refugees, full of asylum seekers. I now have 5 houses with 32 asylum seekers in, and I can do whatever I like with them. So, you know, like, in a way, it's all been... There's been a purpose in it. You know, that's what I mean when I say that behind my life is this story of leading and guidance.
Have you maintained any contact with the asylum seekers you met on Manus?
Well, I haven't, but beautifully enough, neither of them made it to Auburn from that first group. So we were there when the centre opened, before there were any facilities. It was, oh my goodness, it was so primitive. And that group that were there did eventually come to Australia. Another, the group that are there now, obviously, they're being told they will never come. But that first group were told that, but they did come. And I've ran into a lot of them. Some of them have sought me out and come to visit. And it's been a very healing experience because they said, while we felt we had almost no impact, they've talked to us about the impact that we did have. Just being present. Again, the same thing that works for young people worked for them. Just being present. Even if you can't do anything else, a human presence at the moment of pain and trauma is a very healing thing.
What's a typical day for you in Auburn?
Well, it's a bit it's as crazy as it was at Oasis. So we have multiple programs. I run a big community centre now in the heart of Auburn. So we have so many things happening there. We have a driving school.
Why is that so important, the driving?
Oh, well, I mean, work is the best way of helping people who are refugees. Many of the jobs that they can access are ones that are shift work based. So public transport sometimes doesn't get you there. So if we can help them get a licence, that opens up a possibility of getting, you know, shift work, night shift work, aged care work is an area a lot of them work in. We've been able to help them do that. We're running English classes 3 days a week. We have a massive food market where people come and get access to either free or very cheap food. We have a youth program in the afternoon, a dance program. It is like being at Oasis.
But how different are the kind of people that you're working with and the way they present themselves to you and need your help? How different is that from
different.
The kids at Oasis?
Again, I go back to where I started. The biggest challenge for me at Oasis was convincing a person that they were worthwhile, that it was worth investing in this road, that going forward was worthwhile. I don't find that so much with the refugees. They are so aspirational. They just want to be given. They want to get that visa. They want to get that first opportunity. And they will, you know, they're very committed to that. So it's very different in that sense. You don't have to almost convince people or show them that they're worthwhile.
You're at an age, Paul, or heading towards it, when I guess many Australians would be thinking about retiring, what might be next. Not quite yet.
No,
you haven't thought about it. Do you ever think about leaving this sort of work?
No, actually, one of the things, there's a famous Salvation Army book, or written by one of the generals of the Salvation Army, world leaders, and he called his book No Discharge in This War. And I think that's true. I think in this sort of work, there isn't retirement. There maybe is a slowing down and maybe a refocusing, but there's no retirement. I mean, I'll be doing this up until I can. I mean, in the documentary, there was an old man called Ken. I don't, anyone who's seen it will remember Ken.
Ken, who while you were full of kind of compassion and good. Ken is quite sternly looking through windows at these young people misbehaving.
Yeah. But, you know, Ken used to go out and collect in the pubs for me, and he used to raise that money that I could do something extra with the kids with. You know, we'd take them on a trip. Every year we'd try and put a trip on to take them and give them a holiday experience that they'd never have. So he's now in his late 80s. He's in a nursing home, but he still puts his uniform on and goes and does what he can every week. So people like that have been inspirational to me, you know. People who are diverse, Ken had a very different view of the young people. But it's that shared commitment towards others, I think, I've loved working with that diversity of people, and I still love that.
There's a new documentary being made about Oasis, following on where those kids have ended up. Mm. Tell me about your involvement in that.
Yeah, so 10 years on, I think it was 2008, the first documentary was made. They've tried to find the young people, the main characters, and look at where they are today. And they've had a fair bit of success in tracking them down. So that's coming soon. I've been involved in reflecting on the lessons I've learnt and in meeting up with some of the young people. So it's going to be a beautiful experience.
Paul, it's been a real honour to speak with you today. Thank you so much for coming onto Conversations.
Thank you for your time.
Major Paul Moles is Director of the Salvation Army Auburn District, and my conversation with Paul will be up on our website soon, abc.net.au/conversations, and we'll also put a link to the Salvo's work there. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.